Well, hello, faithful listener, and welcome back once again to the podcast that is small of voice, yet large of heart. My name is Darren, and joining me once again this month are the regular, perfectly formed team of Margaret.
Hello.
And Anne.
Hello.
So why not sit back, relax, and enjoy your shoes as we head into yet another hour of music and chat on matters moral, ethical, and spiritual. This month, we have live music from returning guest and fiendish fiddler Sally Simpson, and we'll be reviewing not the Man Booker Prize winner. Stay tuned to find out just what that means. We'll also have our final ever Shelf Life feature, as well as our regular Thousand Words feature and moral mixdown discussion. So in the immortal words of Larry Sanders, no flipping. Did anyone get that other than
I did.
Me? Larry Sanders, no flipping.
Yeah.
Much missed, brilliant show, go
Fantastic.
Find it. Okay, so we start with our Heaven and Hell feature, where we do the quick health check on the team. Margaret, how has life been of late? Heavenly, hellish, or a bit in between?
Well, in one word, Autumn Watch, which is my viewing of choice for this week at least, or it will be once I actually get a chance to sit down in front of the television, that makes everything rather heavenly.
A BBC programme for our overseas
It
listeners.
Is, yes. There are a number of programmes. You have Spring Watch and Autumn Watch. And you might get one of Winter Watch as well. But it's a natural, I suppose, a natural history programme where you see lots of birds flying about and you see animals doing the kind of things that animals do.
And you love it.
It's just a kind of well done, put together.
That's your nice
show,
license
really.
Fee
That's good.
Right there.
Absolutely.
Okay, Anne? With a heavy heart, we tremble and ask for the update. We're going to put this together into an anthology, actually.
Yeah.
A year with Anne.
You know it's not going to be straightforward.
No.
Limbo.
Yes.
Yeah, Limbo, I think.
Last month you were moving out.
I'm out now, but won't be back for several months. Living in temporary accommodation has got kind of limbo quality to it. And I'm waiting to go to a funeral, so it's between losing somebody and being able to say goodbye properly, that kind of limbo state as well. And it feels, I mean, life is coming at me with huge intensity at the minute in all sorts of ways. And I feel as if all the time I'm living in a state just between one big decision and the next. And in all sorts of ways, yes, somewhere hanging about in
You're
the ether.
Safe here for the next hour. Nothing can touch you. Nothing can harm you.
I don't know, Darren. I need to warn you something. Because of that, every time I sit down these days, I just zone out.
Okay.
So that doesn't augur well for sitting around the studio table.
That would be fine. If there's moments of silence, then you know people can cope with that. Maybe that would be breaking new ground on the radio. Mine is quite monumental in some ways. In a couple of days' time, I shall be turning 50. And I have a number of heavenly things set up, you know, meals with families and friends and all manner of celebrations. And on Monday next week, I'm actually starting a new job, which is trepidation. Uh-huh. But the hell for me is because you'll know around this table, we're all teachers or former teachers. You know, October is not a good time to leave.
Yeah.
And I have some classes where it's quite painful to leave them behind, and I know it's kind of not exactly the greatest fun for them either. All shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, but it's a little bit melancholy, you know, be going in tomorrow, and I won't cry, but
maybe you will,
because I'm hard-hearted and, you know,
but scared. surely some of your tender-hearted pupils will shed a tear. Or maybe not.
You've not been in my classroom, have you? Anyway, it's a big mix for me, and I think I'm just going to do what people always say about the whole... I mentioned that it was the 50th, yeah? Because, I mean, I know I don't get any sympathy, not to give any secrets away around this table, but I think I'm just going to do the stereotypical embrace it and go with it, you know? What can you do?
That would be my advice.
Well, the years just kind of keep coming on. I mean,
it's better than the alternative,
it, really.
That's
yeah.
what I use.
Darren, I think you would appreciate one of the things that happened to me this week when I was due to go and give a talk to some pupils in school, and it was the modern studies teacher who'd arranged it. He told me that he'd managed to arrange for the other two first year classes to get out of maths to come and hear me.
Oh, outrage. Oh, I tell you, that makes my blood. Oh, don't get me started.
I'll not tell you
seriously.
What school it was.
Well, do you want an A in your higher maths or not? That's all I am saying. Ooh. Now, before we move on, a quick hello to regular listeners Bruce and Katrina. Bruce particularly enjoyed our dissection of the popular media mega-brands Strictly Come Dancing and The X Factor, whilst Katrina sent us a picture of her cats listening to last month's podcast, though I confess it's not immediately clear what part of the show they are listening to. Now, in last month's podcast, I said we'd be reviewing the winner of the Man Booker Prize in our next media review. You may also recall that we each chose one of the shortlisted books at random and undertook to read it for this month's podcast as well. So, how did all that turn out? Over to you, Margaret, to explain.
Thanks, Dan. I think I should say it was actually you that did the choosing, It wasn't Anne and me. But
it was random.
Never mind. It was random.
Rest assured, it was random.
Yes. Anyway, the situation was that the actual winner was due to be announced halfway between Small Voice Recordings, and of course, it was possible that one of us would be reading that work. However, as it turned out, all of our books were among the losers. But to complicate matters, or in fact make it much simpler for us, none of us actually fancied reading the winner, which was A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James. Probably too much violence in the title, I think. So,
can I just say, if it had been six killings, I would have been on board.
You'd have been all right.
Just about.
Okay.
Diving right in.
Anyway, you spoiled my big fanfare for the very first time on the Small Voice Media Review. We each have a different work to put forward as designated in last month's podcast. So, Anne, what did you read and what did you think of it?
Well, I was randomly allocated Satin Island by Tom McCarthy. First of all, a public health warning: if you're the sort of person that likes a rattling good yarn, this is not the book for you. There is no plot to speak of. It begins at what appears to be I know you're sighing deeply, Darren, but I am going to say really good things about this book.
Okay.
Begins at a kind of random point, and the ending is truly pathetic. That is pathetic with a B, not with a P. But there's fair warning in the book itself. The central character says early on, if you want events, you'd best stop reading now, and that would be the case. However, it's not about events, and it's not really even about the characters, because neither the narrator, who's just referred to as you, that's the letter U, nor indeed the handful of other characters that are his colleagues and friends, are more than really sketchily outlined. We don't really find out anything about their lives beyond their work life and their kind of central... Well, really, we're immersed in the consciousness of the narrator, you. However, it is an incredibly thought-provoking book. It is very funny, I think. Though not many of the reviews say so, maybe it's just me, but I find it hugely entertaining. Brief description. Yu spends his life looking for connections between seemingly random events. He quotes Levi Strauss, the anthropologist, who said, you should always write everything down as an anthropologist, because the minute you edit, you may miss what is really significant, because we don't know really what is significant about tribes that are not our own. And he follows that and therefore is interested in everything. And I think this is why I so enjoyed the book. It's probably quite a narcissistic thing, because I'm very like that. I'm the sort of person that cuts random articles out of random magazines and transcribes bits of overheard conversations on buses, and I'm always looking for the patterns and the meanings. And every now and again, I think I have this great epiphany, and maybe it is and maybe it isn't, but that's how you, the central character, lives his life. And essentially, I think that's what makes us human. We're meaning makers, and particularly as people of faith, we're looking for meaning. And in truth, this book is suffused in religious language and imagery, and really shot through with it. And therefore, I think would probably particularly appeal to people of faith. So it has my recommendation, Satin Island by Tom McCarthy, unless you want a good plot.
Well, that sounds interesting. So that's a definite plus.
Yes.
Darren?
Yeah, I got allocated a book called The Fisherman by Chigozie Obioma, an African novelist. It's set in Nigeria in the 1990s, during kind of periods of unrest, and it tells the story of a family where the father has to leave for work elsewhere, so the family, which consists mainly of four boys, is left to fend for themselves with the mother. there's a local madman around who basically... The boys go off and fish, and they shouldn't do that. That's a bad thing, apparently, because the river's not safe. And hence the fisherman part of it. The local madman seems to be a kind of prophet figure, and he prophesies that the eldest son is going to die at the hands of one of the other boys. And basically, that prophecy slowly unhinges the eldest son, and the rest of the boys are left to cope. Now, you talked about, if you want a rattling good read, that actually, in terms of a plot, sounds quite exciting. I don't think it's a rattling good read in that sense, and it's a bit timey-wimey because there's kind of flashbacks and flash forwards and so on. It's told sort of in first person by one of the younger brothers, and so it has that kind of naivety about it. I have to say, if you know a bit about Nigerian politics, it probably helps, and I hold my hand up here and say I know nothing, and certainly there's not many. What's the phrase I'm looking for? They don't make it easy for you if you don't. I have to say I didn't enjoy it. Sometimes I feel with great literature you kind of have to endure it, and towards the end of it you can say, oh, well okay, I feel the better for having read it. I remember when I was at school reading Grapes of Wrath, and maybe I was too young, but at the time I kind of found it quite something to get through. But towards the end I began to appreciate that this had been really quite something. Just what can I say? Not for me. Not particularly cheery. I don't. I begin to think that you get on the Man Booker shortlist by simply not writing rattling good reads. So, Margaret, what was yours? I know we're probably running out of time here.
Well, mine was The Year of the Runaways by Sanjeev Sahota, and I found it quite difficult to get into. Partly because of the language. There were a lot of words unfamiliar to me. The Runaways are all from India, and they're all in the UK, and they come together. The book kind of goes through the background of some of these young people. There's something like 13 living together in a house. We only hear about three of them. And one other as well. And as I say, initially I found it quite difficult because it's a totally alien culture to me. I worked out that they... Well, I worked out. They're Sikhs. And again, it's something I'm not at all familiar with. The language that they were using, I was not familiar. There's lots of words. You can sort of work out what they're saying, but it's the slang expressions that you can... And that's a bit of a barrier, really. Well,
sometimes you kind of get immersed in that, and it almost doesn't matter too much.
After a while, you don't really notice. It's not significant. It's just the way they talk. I think the other problem I had, actually, was that it was very much a kind of male-dominated world.
Oh, right.
And... So the kind of culture of young men, again, was totally unfamiliar. But, you know, probably quite a good thing for me to do it. The impression I came away with in the end, there is quite a lot of religion in it as well. And I hope people wouldn't take it negatively to say I felt it would be a good book for young people to read, because it does expose you to that different culture. And to the way that all these young people had arrived in the UK, why they were there, what they were doing. I think they were all there illegally, one way and another. They hadn't all started off that way. But that whole kind of culture and the sort of impression that for none of them, it wasn't really their fault. So I ended up quite sympathetic. I wasn't altogether happy with the conclusion, but yes, I liked it better by the end than I had at the beginning, I think.
So to summarise, that's a yes to Saturn Island by Tom McCarthy. A qualified yes to...
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably wasn't for me, but a sort of, like the kind of book you read in school, like you ought to.
Yeah, and a kind of, not really for me, for The Fisherman by Chigozie Obioma. I should say, the winner, A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James, is quite a violent book, and I think the reason that I should explain, it's not just that we thought, oh, you know, it turned our nose up at it, Anne. I think you genuinely get quite disturbed by that sort of thing.
Yeah, I do know. Yeah.
And I think, Margaret, you thought life was too short. And basically, with me, I was killed off as soon as I discovered that Irvin Welsh said it was a great book, and that's just my prejudice showing, so you'll have to forgive me for that. We're delighted to welcome back Sally Simpson to our Small Voice studio. Sally, thank you so much for agreeing to come back.
Not at all. Thank you for having me back.
Now, you played for our Christmas 2013 show, and then you were kind enough to allow us to play a couple of pieces, audition pieces, I believe, for your studies in Sweden. So the first thing I'm going to have to ask is, how was Sweden?
Sweden was incredible. So I'm just back from a year studying there at the Royal Music College in Stockholm. And it was absolutely amazing. Brilliant music scene.
And you come back with the ability to speak Swedish?
It's not what I'd call fluently, but yes, I can get by without English in any case. They do speak incredibly good English out there, which can make it a lot more difficult, except all of my classes, because I was in quite a small folk music department, all of the classes were taught in in Swedish. Yeah. So you kind of learned it by osmosis to a certain extent.
And is it the kind of thing, and with Germans are like this, you go into a shop and you ask something in your halting language and then they just answer in perfect English?
Yeah, it's exactly like that, but except that they speak incredibly good English. So they're quite happy to switch to English very quickly. Also, they've got a very big immigrant and refugee community in Sweden. It's much better for open borders than a lot of Europe. So a lot of the people speaking English to you don't have Swedish as their first language either.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we don't have webcam, but I think I'm allowed to say that you're pretty tall and you're blonde. Did you ever get a great mistaken for being Swedish moment?
To a certain extent, except that I think quite a lot of people asked, do you get mistaken for being Swedish? Because I am 5'11" and still fairly blonde, clinging on to the blonde. But speaking to people here, I don't think if you meet a stranger, you don't really look at them and assess whether or not they look British or Scottish or Glaswegian before deciding how you speak to them. You go for it and then figure out,
so
okay.
We're just being guilty of stereotyping here.
Yeah, except that you are kind of right in that, generally speaking, they're a lot taller and much blonder, although somehow I ended up with a group of friends who were all considerably shorter than I was, again. So it's still a constant battle to keep my height in conversation.
And now you're back for your final year at the Conservatoire, that's right?
Yes, yeah, slightly scary feelings.
You'll have to grow up at some point, won't you?
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
Now, do you want to tell us about your first piece of music that you're going to play for us?
The first piece of music I'm going to play is the melody from an old Gaelic love song called An Charla Jurach, which translates as the Earl of Jura. And the lyrics to the song are from a woman's point of view, lamenting the loss of her love, the Earl of Jura. Not so much a loss through death, but I think he's run off with someone else. And she's taking a slightly defeatist attitude and thinking life is over. It's a lovely melody, but I do resent her sentiment.
Okay, we'll listen for a radical feminist reinterpretation. Okay, so this is Sally Simpson playing, and I'm not going to give you the Gaelic, but this is the Earl of Jura. Thank you. great, Sally. Thank you so much. Typical cheery Scottish stuff. Out of interest, because I mean, okay, that wasn't a Swedish thing. I'm not going to bang on too much about the Swedish stuff, but
feel free.
Do you pick up Swedish influences in your playing? I mean, I remember. Sorry, quick, boring. Reminisce from me. I remember going to the Ortamakti Folk Festival and hearing someone getting a row for going off the chart. And I think they were accused of being a bit Irish in their fiddling or something. So, you know, now that you're back, the people sometimes go, oh, that sounded, I think there was an umlaut in there or something.
people do mention occasionally that there's a slight kind of Swedish accent to my playing. I mean, when I've tried playing Swedish music, I sound Scottish, definitely. But the ornamentation is such a big element of folk music, whichever tradition you're in, and a simple melody is very much kind of embellished and
forgive me,
made
by ornamentation
own,
you mean
or ornamentation. Sort of grace notes, the way you choose to voice things, the little notes in between, okay. Or bowing style, that sort of thing, and so while when I play Swedish music it still sounds Scottish, I think there are certain little twitches almost that that I quite liked about Swedish music that I've then applied to Scottish traditional music.
And I mean, are there still the kind of rigid traditionalists versus the kind of people a bit freer and saying, oh, come on?
I think there will always be those people in every music tradition, really. And in Scottish music, or certainly the Scottish folk scene generally, there's so much new stuff happening, so many new influences, which is brilliant. There are always people trying to preserve the old stuff, but a lot of the people doing the most kind of groundbreaking stuff in Scottish traditional music now, I think, are actually people who are very, very well versed in the old style as well, but aren't afraid to take it forwards. And I think that's a very good way to be.
Almost sounds like a wee sermon there.
Oops. Apologies.
No, we approve of that wholeheartedly. Now, we'll get you back to play another tune later on in the show. And I believe that one of the it's going to be a set, and one of the tunes you're going to play is one that you've actually written with someone over from Sweden.
Yeah, correct.
So we'll have that later. So for just now, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time for our feature, 1,000 Words. So Anne, who's your guest this month?
Well, every now and again, an interviewee so obviously incarnates their values that you barely need to ask them a question. You just sit and you listen. And that was the case with my guest this month, Alison Phipps. Alison is Professor of Languages and Intercultural Studies at the University of Glasgow. She's also a foster mother and co-convener of the Glasgow Refugee, Asylum and Migration Network. This organisation brings together researchers and practitioners and policymakers working with migrants, refugees and asylum seekers in Scotland. Here she is describing what is a very personal photograph.
So there's a young man and he's got an enormous smile on his face and he's spreading his arms out, and behind him there's a huge flag of Scotland. The young man is a young man I befriended in Dungavell Immigration Removal Centre, and his name is Solomon Rashid. And the picture was a picture taken of him in the craft room that was on St Andrew's Day, and he was really just celebrating that day in that place, which is a place of limited hope for many people. And his face was so alive with spirit and hope and youth and vitality. And I've chosen this image because it really just lives with me as a sign of what we lose. Solomon Rashid was a peaceful man. He was from Iraq and he was held in the detention centre for a long period of time and eventually was deported back to Iraq after the end of the Iraq war. Many of us had campaigned against his removal from the country, and a couple of weeks after he was removed from the country he was killed by a bomb on the roadside. So that image was one which he'd shared with us and which came to us as his friends, the people who'd befriended him in the centre. And it was one that we then used because I think all of us who'd known him and who felt the waste of life and who felt the injustice of the deportation of people to countries which are still unsafe, we really felt we wanted to do something to remember him. And so we gathered on a very wet evening in George Square with tiny little candles, and we cupped the candles in our hands, kind of sheltering them from the rain, and we took pictures, the picture that we'd had of him, full of life and vitality, and we held that picture with candles underneath it. against ourselves, and we just said we would stand for an hour in silence and we would say a few things to remember him and remember his life. But we would stand there peacefully and we would hold a vigil and keep silence to remember all who had been deported and who had died as a result, but particularly Solomon Rashid.
It feels particularly important to have an image like this at a time when the language of government becomes more and more depersonalised and inhuman.
Absolutely. One of the things that I study is the causes of genocide. What is it that prevents people having good relationships with one another? What kinds of things might lead people very rapidly to commit mass murder? Often ordinary human beings who report afterwards that they don't quite know what overcame them, that they didn't believe they were people who could have done this. And these are witnesses and testimonies we've had from the Armenian, the Holocaust and the Rwandan genocides in particular. And in some of the research on genocide, there's a 10-point scale that is offered, and point four speaks about the use of language to describe other human beings as insects, to dehumanise them, to speak of them as animals. And I think we have seen this language used very deliberately in our own country by our own Prime Minister recently, who has spoken of people fleeing persecution as swarms, who has referred to them as people who are breaking into our country. And this is not just a point about political correctness, it's actually a very serious point about the permission to use what is genocidal language in a public space. It's point four on a scale of genocide to be using that kind of language. Point five then sees us setting aside elements of the rule of law around those people who are being described in those terms. And we're also seeing that at the moment with the suspension of appeal rights for asylum seekers, with the suspension of other rights for particular migrant groups, and more recently with the revisiting of questions around refugee status even after it's been granted. So we're also now seeing a very worrying trend to being at the midpoint on a series that leads us towards being a country that is potentially capable of these kinds of acts of mass killing. And I say that also advisedly, watching some of the statistics and data that have come through from State Watch recently, which is an organisation that monitors the kinds of indicators that show that a state is moving in a very dangerous direction. And many of the states on the list of top 20 are the ones you would imagine, where we know at the moment there's a lot of killing. But there's another list of the 20 states which have made the greatest percentage increase in likelihood. And there are some very worrying names on that list. Myanmar and Thailand and Kenya are just three examples. But also on that list for the first time is the UK. And this, therefore, for me, means that I think we're living in dangerous times. We're living in times that require a great deal of vigilance from our leaders in public space for the language that they use, real attention to how we speak of other people. And I think where we may not see leadership coming from our own Prime Minister, we have seen leadership coming from within the political classes within Scotland, often across the board, not just from one party. Recently, the Minister for External Relations and for Europe, Hamza Youssef, saying that he wished Scotland to be known as a compassionate country, and hearing even the First Minister condemning language which dehumanised people. And I think that's the kind of leadership you need to really take you out of that danger zone and be in a place where you will not be a country that is as capable of deporting people to countries where you know their lives will be at risk. And I think I'd also want to say that some of the work I do involves travelling to countries to which people have been deported. And so I was recently in the Sudan, and as I was in the Sudan, I met up with a man from Eritrea who had his own little rickshaw business, and we got talking, and he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "I'm from the UK." And he said, "I hate the UK." And I asked him why, and he said, "I was in detention for 6 years in the UK, and then I was deported back to Eritrea. I was tortured for 2 years. Eventually, I escaped, and now I'm living in Sudan. I hate the UK." And I thought to myself, this is an example of how we end up breeding resentment for years, for decades later, how we end up actually jeopardising our own peace and our own security by the way that we treat the least among us, by the way that we treat our neighbour, by the way that we treat the stranger at our gate. So for me, as a person who prays, it's really, I think, very significant that we have an injunction to care for the stranger, that we are asked within our faith tradition, within my faith tradition, to provide sanctuary to the stranger. I think that this isn't just a thing to do because your heart is breaking at how people are being treated, though that's one of the reasons. It's also, there's a pragmatism to it about what makes for good neighbourly relations and what means that as countries, but also as neighbours, we can live with each other in a way that means we can still have a conversation with each other over the fence, that things don't break down completely between us. And I think those are the things that, you know, led me to want to visit people in detention centres, to be able to say that someone like the young man in the picture was my friend.
Now, I normally at this point I ask you where we can go to see the picture, the photograph, but can I just say, there's part of me that wants to put out a decree that across the land, across the land's churches on Sunday, people should just play that instead of having a sermon.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite life-changing listening to Alison Phipps. And it also kind of puts into perspective things that we know already are happening. You know, we all know that to refer to migrants as swarms is not good. But what I think I had failed to really understand is how close that is to the kind of language of Nazi Germany before Kristallnacht.
Yeah.
And when you begin to see it in that perspective, and when you find yourself as a nation now on a kind of top 10 of who is moving towards the possibility of genocide, you really have to stop. You really have to stop.
But for the record, if people want to see the photograph?
For the record, you can see this wonderful photograph on our website, www.smallvoice.org.uk. And we'll also put a link there to the Glasgow Refugee, Asylum and Migration Network. Although it's called the Glasgow Network, it has lots there that would be useful no matter where you live.
That's great. Regular listeners will be familiar with our shelf life feature by now, wherein one of the team holds up a piece of art or book or novel or whatever as being of particular artistic worth when it comes to developing our understanding and appreciation of faith and being worthy of a place on our virtual bookshelf. Well, that shelf is pretty full by now. Have a look at our website, smallvoice.org.uk, and you'll see what I mean. And so we've decided to give the feature a rest, though we reserve the right to add stuff every now and then, or who knows, to redecorate completely. I mean, I'm sure IKEA bring out new virtual bookshelves all the time. We'll be unveiling a brand new feature soon, which will take the place of Shelf Life, but meantime, it falls to me to pitch one last time. Now, I've mulled over this for a while. What would my last choice be? I thought of suggesting Doctor Who, because why wouldn't you? I also wondered if Charles M. Schulz's Peanuts cartoon strip shouldn't win a place. Same reason. But eventually I saw the light and realised that there could only really be one final choice for me. And can I just point out for the listeners at home at this point that for once we've kept the secret, neither Anne nor Margaret know what's coming. For the first time, in effect, I'm going to pitch for us to have an actual person on the shelf, as it were, although I might narrow it down to one of their works. Now, you are in for a treat. All I can say at this point, you should just sit back and listen, and everything will hopefully become clear.
It's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown. It's been cloudy and cold, and dismal, quiet. It's a hard time of year back where I come from, March. It's more like an illness than a month. Spring is almost here, but you can't really be sure. It's a difficult time when our Christian faith is at a very low ebb, indeed. And all of those triumphant hymns seem utterly not quite true. And the ones about the beauty of the earth, give me a break. They're not even close. Have anything to do with anything. It just seems as if the resurrection, which is scheduled for 2 weeks from today, may not take place. It seems unlikely in March. I'm not sure why. There are different ideas why this month is so hard on us back there and gives us the blues so badly.
Now, I've been doing this radio lark or podcast lark for a while now, and, you know, there's a basic rule in life, which is never, ever be the person whose voice has to follow Garrison Keillor, OK? For people who don't know, that was the American humorist and broadcaster Garrison Keillor, who presents a regular radio show called A Prairie Home Companion, in which he has a monologue about his made-up hometown of Lake Wobegon. And there's developed characters, and there's you go through the year, and there's a lot of references to church life, be it Lutheran or Roman Catholic. The one thing I would say is, you know, you may have heard of Garrison Keillor. It's whether you've heard Garrison Keillor. I read his first novel, Lake Wobegon Days, and did not get it for one second that I hadn't heard the voice. But he is an incredibly funny man. Now, he's very tall, so he'd have to stoop to get on our bookshelf. But I should explain, because in essence, he's very funny. So why not? Why not just have him for that? But if I can very quickly explain, one of the best nights of my life was being fortunate enough, and I think Anne, you were there. We've heard Garrison Keillor a few times, but he brought along his Hopeful Gospel Quartet, and he had a little monologue about the performing gospel birds, which was hilarious, but ended with basically actually, you know what, it's on YouTube, you'll find it, but it ends with him saying that as a child, supposedly when he went to hear this, it was the first time he'd heard about how God loved you and it didn't really matter what you were like, and it was a really positive message. And the amazing thing is that he's out there doing this. And I've read people going on about how, you know, Garrison Keillor is a terrible person. I mean, he gets through wives. Let's just notice that. But basically the message of God loving and caring for you and not judging you, you know, not being the big bad. And that was, you would think I would have heard that message before, but in that evening it was amazing. So anyway, I think Garrison Keillor should stoop and go onto our Small Voice bookshelf. In fact, maybe he should just stand with his arms outstretched and all the books and whatnot can hang off him, because he is full of deep insight, is what I would say. Margaret, you're aware of his oeuvre?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, I mean, I think as soon as you hear that voice, you know that you're in for a treat, an audio treat. And I would have to say, I think the one time I actually saw Garrison Keillor in person, I was distracted by his hands, and that sort of took me away from the voice. So I'd rather just listen, but I could listen all day long. Mm-hmm. And yes, the profound nature of what is behind what he's actually talking about is absolutely fascinating.
Anne?
I'm so glad you thought of him. as the last item for the shelf, because it would not have been complete without him. It is wonderful. His voice is wonderful. There's such kindness and such love behind everything that he writes. He has to be there. And yeah, you're right. He's got through, I think, three or four marriages up to this point. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Gospel Birds, I think, is one of the most beautiful things, as well as one of the funniest things I have ever heard. And if you haven't heard it, as Darren said, go and look for it.
Yeah, and be aware, I think once he's on form, the monologues can be about 15, 20 minutes, but
yes,
it doesn't matter.
Sit
down, get yourself a cup of hot chocolate.
Yeah.
You know? And I think also for us, it's because he always talks about the weather, and that with the Scots, that always resonates, you know. Actually, unusually for our Heaven and Hell feature, Margaret didn't. Oh, you did talk about the weather. You talked about autumn. So there you go.
Well, that's the season. It's not the necessarily the weather.
So yeah, I mean, I think the votes are cast. We bow before the might, and we are truly not worthy in terms of you know, what we can put out there to compare to the body of work and it's such a love of radio as well, which I think we all have. So if you're new to that, I would say don't go for the novels. You know, you can get onto that if you want. Go and have a look on YouTube, or if you don't want to be distracted by flappy hands, just get the audio, and you will be in for a treat.
Yeah.
time for some more music. Thanks again for joining us, Sally.
Not at all.
I didn't mention this to you before, but we're actually going to throw something at you now, which maybe you weren't aware of. We have now got a feature, because you've been with the show for so long. It's kind of evolved while you were away. And we now have a little feature with our musical guests where we ask them to answer five questions about music. Just answer honestly, and if you do well, then you get to play your second piece and you get to plug your concerts and stuff. And you actually have a website now, I believe.
So, I do.
So, you know, this is a game worth playing. All you have to do is answer honestly, and it's called A Small Voice, Life in the Five Songs. Mm-hmm. So the first one, you're a bit young, but, you know, can you recall the first single you bought or downloaded or whatever?
Oh, it might well have been something S Club 7 related, but I remember that my first two albums were Classical Music for Children album that I got from my granny, and Blazing Fiddles first album, Fire On, that I got from my aunt, and that's still one of my absolute favourite CDs.
The Blazing Fiddles one.
The Blazing Fiddles one. the Classics for Children one. I think Disc 2's gone missing.
Okay. Karaoke song of choice. I should say, by the way, you're allowed tunes as well, but you know.
Well, see, I live with a singer. I live with a singer called Hannah Rarity, and although she's a folk music singer, she's a big fan of anything kind of dramatic. So last Friday night, instead of being conventional students going out, we thought we'd stay in and do some work, and it turned into a massive ABBA marathon. Really shameless. Shameful, actually. So probably something ABBA. Possibly The Winner Takes All, although it's a bit miserable, but favourite dancing around the kitchen song is Don't Stop Believin', Journey.
Ah, there we go. Yeah. So, blonde, Swedish, ABBA.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of playing into a stereotype here, but yeah,
haven't I? Now, song or tune that you wish you'd written?
Oh, there's a good few of them. One of my favourite songs is by my old fiddle teacher, actually, Mary Campbell, and it's called Smile or Cry. And it's just a lovely, lovely kind of slightly melancholic song, saying that in difficult situations your choice is either to smile or cry. And now, it's lovely, relevant.
That might be an answer to the next question, actually, which was, have you got a favourite hymn or chorus or a kind of song of inspiration?
Oh, well, Smile or Cry might well fall into that. Because it says, whatever's going on, you can look at it both ways. I think one line in the chorus is, because the pool of the flowing tide could pull me back or sweep me away type thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to see that things can go both ways.
Good. And finally, we get so many young folk in these days. For a while we did have a lot of older Scottish males, which leads you to talk about death. So it's a bit harsh to ask you about your funeral. But, you know, if there was a song to play as you went away, what would it be?
Ooh.
I'm pleased to see you haven't thought of this.
Yeah. Yep, I haven't.
We can just dig out the album.
My dad occasionally mentioned things for his thing, and actually he got annoyed when we were out on the hills around Christmas time and I took a lovely photo of him and went, Dad, look, this is your funeral photo. I don't think he took it quite how it was intended, but I don't know how you could. I quite like the... there was a funeral Mum went to a few years ago and she came back and said, The final song was always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Yeah. I think I'd be tempted to go for that.
Yeah. A defiant gesture on the way. Okay. Well, listen, you've answered correctly. Of course you have, because it's you. So do you want to tell us about your second set? I think it's a set of tunes, isn't it?
Yeah, a set of two tunes. The first one is called Knots and Crosses. Although I think I usually use the Swedish title, but I don't trust myself to pronounce it correctly right now. Kriso Ring, I think it is. And I wrote that together with a guitarist in Stockholm called Johan Nilsson, who we took it phrase about. So I wrote one phrase, he wrote the next, or possibly vice versa, I can't quite remember, and kind of then compromised on it overall. And we couldn't come up with a name for it. But Johan is a really kind of charming guy who really can't do enough to help all of his friends, or complete strangers for that matter. So you kind of think, You're almost too nice. And then I ended up playing Knots and Crosses with him once and found that that's where the dark side came out. He was fiercely competitive. I think the words prepare to die, Simpson, came around, which were the least Johan-like words I'd ever heard. So that's called Knots and Crosses, and it's followed by a traditional reel called The Prince's Welcome to Inverness.
Okay, so this is Sally Simpson. Get yourself in place. This is Noughts and Crosses and The Prince's Welcome to Inverness. Great, Sally. Thank you so much. Now, I believe you have some product finally to plug. You know, you've earned the right to talk about gigs, websites, bar mitzvahs.
Yeah, so I finally...
You're a busy person these days, I think.
Yeah. Starting to build up more exciting stuff that's going on. So later on this month, I have a recital with a very good friend of mine and fantastic fiddle player from Sweden called Magdalena Eriksson. We're playing at the Scots Fiddle Festival on the 21st, Saturday the 21st of November. There's a series of recitals every day and we'll be playing in Summerhall at 2 o'clock.
That's in Edinburgh, yeah.
That's in Edinburgh, yeah. Yes.
Right, and the website, do you know it by heart?
Yes, I do. that was actually a product of my last visit to GRF was, right, I need to get a website on the go. So I'm now at www.sallysimpsonmusic.co.uk.
And am I right that some of your stuff is now on SoundCloud?
I've got
seen or heard some stuff.
Yep, I've got a recording of a composition I've done on SoundCloud, as well as a few collaborations with Hannah Rarity, the singer who I mentioned earlier, and a couple of videos from a farewell concert I did in Stockholm are also available there and on YouTube.
All right, so presumably your website kind of points to
points to all of that and links to other folk that I'm working with as well.
But you've been busy. Listen, you've now got that internet presence at Twitter.
Not yet.
Working on it? Not yet
on Twitter.
Instagram?
No. Well, the thing is, I waste enough of my time on Facebook that I'm scared to go anywhere else. I don't know what more time I have to procrastinate.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming. It's been great. That's your kind of second trip live to the studio. And I'm sure we'll get you back next year if you're up for that.
Thanks for having me and thanks for your support.
Okay. As ever, we finish with the moral mixdown. Now, sometimes we deal with big world events here. It's a bit smaller scale, but in recognition that it's November, and I don't know if this is the same in other countries for our international listeners, but certainly in the UK, everyone gets very, very excited when certain things happen in November, including the first Christmas adverts. The John Lewis Christmas advert is due out any moment, and apparently we're all on tenterhooks. I wasn't aware of this, but still. But the people at Mulberry, who produce luxury goods, including bags, they've kind of stolen a march on that, and they've produced a very glossy advert for television, which has got quite a lot of media attention, because in the kind of joke advert, they take the nativity, but instead of it being the baby Jesus, essentially everyone is worshipping a red Mulberry bag. This has caused a little reaction. I'm not sure the Daily Mail is fully revved up into outrage mode yet. But there is perhaps a genuine question as to whether or not the advert could be deemed offensive, or what it tells us about ourselves, or indeed about Mulberry. So, Margaret, assuming that you've seen the advert, and we'll put a link so that people can, are you offended? Are you outraged of Larbert?
I'm just very disappointed that it wasn't me that wrote it. I thought when I saw that, I thought it was brilliant, because it just kind of puts things into place, and to me that's actually the kind of thing that we do in our
normal stuff. So you're choosing to take the advert as kind of satire on people worshipping consumer goods.
I suppose so. Yes, yeah. Yes, uh-huh. Yes, indeed. And I just actually what makes me I kind of wonder why Mulberry are doing it, because how many folk are going to go and spend hundreds of pounds on a bag after that? I don't know. There is some kind of subtlety in adverts, but I'd have thought it was a sort of almost against themselves.
I do have my generic fruit based tablet here, Margaret, and I'm happy to tell you Mulberry Willow handbag, £1,297, or from Mulberry the Bayswater and Black Natural, £997. I mean, we are talking at the thousands here, so yeah. And what about you? Are you outraged, offended, dismayed,
well,
jealous?
For the first time, I honestly didn't know whether I thought it was brilliant or seriously offensive. Maybe both. I think it's maybe both. Because I have a feeling they've taken it straight as let's have a laugh based on the nativity story. But it is well done. It's cleverly scripted. It's beautifully shot. But really, should you be replacing the saviour of the world with a handbag? I'm not sure it's funny. I'm not sure it makes me laugh. But on the other hand, I accept it as a good piece of writing. Not sure it's a good piece of advertising, just to come back to what we were saying earlier, because recent research would suggest that most of the folk who would buy the bag won't know that it's based on the nativity story. They won't recognise the story that it's based on, because they're not quite sure who Jesus is anyway. So I think that might not particularly work in advertising terms.
Yeah, I actually saw it tonight for the first time. A little bit nonplussed. I mean, there's others in the team who've said, really not sure what to make of this. Mm. I find it a bit smug. I mean, the thing about this is serious high-end. Now, you know, we're sitting in a studio surrounded by reasonably, you know, we have not gone to Lidl for our recording equipment, you know, and there is stuff where, you know, to be broadcast quality, you have to pay and you have to get that. I have no idea how good a bag can be that costs that much, you know.
Well, that's the fascinating thing. It's not, I don't think it's about the quality of the bag anymore. It's become an icon, become a thing in and of itself, which you are supposed to aspire to and want, essentially. And in a way, that's the more interesting thing to me, is how on earth did we get to the place where women have been duped into treating things like bags and shoes as things to aspire to spend £1,000 on, in a world where people starve to death. So that, for me, that's the more interesting thing. How is it that we've been conned in this way to think they are things of such beauty, and to something to be aspired to? I'm not quite sure how it's happened.
Yeah, I think it is a, well, it's a different kind of lifestyle. I mean, yeah, I don't, I have a sort of,
we are not the target audience.
We're not the target audience. I was thinking I'll probably never see it on the television, because the kind of programmes I watch, or the adverts, are quite different.
Not on
from
after
that.
Jeremy Kyle, is it? No.
Well, it might be, actually. I don't know. I haven't seen that. But I was just thinking, you know, I have a threshold or whatever for when I buy certain things, how much would I pay for it? And, you know, I remember looking at a bag, actually, several years ago, and I thought, this is really nice. But it was £50, and I thought, there's no way I'm going to pay £50. There is no bag in the world. And I would probably still take a sort of similar... it would still be about the same figure, really, and I kind of wait until it's in the sale, and then it's reduced by another 20% on the day, and then, you know, you actually get to a price that you can afford to pay for. I was funnily enough trying on coats 2 or 3 weeks ago, and in the shop sort of looked at the prices and thought, oh, I'm not paying that for a very nice coat and all that, and you sort of try it on, it fits quite nicely, and you think, oh, well, yeah. And I found myself sort of coming away from the shop having said, no, I'm actually not going to buy any of these things. Well, maybe, you know, it does fit. Not, wait a minute. No, it doesn't fit that well. And, you know, and then...
Is there a voice inside going, you deserve this, you know, because they do try and kind of point you towards that. You've worked hard. Yeah. You deserve, treat yourself.
Well,
my
problem too is, Dan, I work for a charity.
Yeah.
And... You know, there are folk who are going to look and say, "All right,
Oh, right, I see. They're going to say, "Mulberry bag." I'm not donating anything to you. Yeah.
But there's a level beyond this in terms of bags and shoes, because, you know, a coat at least is useful. A winter coat is very useful. But most people who buy these bags, they would never take them out in the rain. They would never actually use them in any sort of obvious way. They put them away in wardrobes and every now and again take them out and admire them as works of art. And that's the trick that I can't understand how it's been played.
Yeah. It can be pernicious. I mean, from a school perspective, I mean, you know, I joked about, you know, other computers are available, you know, Apple versus all the others. But I know from teaching that what kind of mobile phone kids have is hugely important to them. I naively asked the kids once, I said, well, so what kind of, you know, I had a little brick, you know, so what kind of phone should I get? And they were astonished I was even asking, because the answer was it had to be an iPhone, because that says you've got money.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that's scary if you are on a budget and then have to aspire to... Providing that for your kids.
This is what is really so terrifying. If children don't know their own worth as human beings, then it is terrifying now that it can only be in terms of possessions like iPhones. And it almost feels now that it's too late to pull back from that. We've missed the chance to tell children that they are worth infinite amounts just by being themselves. And I don't quite know how a teenager now would stand against that. I don't know how you would work against that peer pressure now.
Good luck to the parents saying, you're worth more than an iPhone, which is why I'm giving you this one, a Schmeiphone from Sweden with four umlauts.
Yeah, I think perhaps our outlook on life, I would include all of us in that are sitting around this table here, is kind of counter cultural,
yeah,
because the world wants to make money and show that it is rich and do that by having possessions that are better than it. You know, my car's bigger than yours, my phone is newer than yours, mm-hmm, all of that sort of competition. And I think what we can do is step aside from that and say that is not, and just keep saying that's not what matters. Mm-hmm. It's not what you have. There's a song that one of these, it's a song by Stuart Townend, who has written an awful lot of songs, and I'll never get the words right, but it's not what you have, it's what you have left when you've given everything else away. That yeah, kind of idea that is the goal is not to have, but to give. Yeah. And that's the message that we've got to keep putting out there.
Okay, so we're basically saying, nicely done, Mulberry. We see what you did there, but at the same time, we see what you do. Well, folks, there you have it. Our 60 minutes is more or less up. Doesn't time just fly by when you're having fun? But fear ye not, the Small Voice crew will be back next month with our special festive Crimbo podcast to banish those winter blues and make your Advent go zing with minty fresh confidence. Feel free to rearrange that last sentence into something coherent, but in the meantime, why not follow us on Twitter @small_voice1, subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, or just drop by our website at smallvoice.org.uk to say hello. We shall be waiting.